Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You've been hearing ads for Zencastr for these past months. Interested in sponsoring this show or podcast ads for your business? Go to zen.ai/thearchaeologyshow and fill out the contact information so Zencastr can help you bring your business story to life.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, welcome to The Archaeology Show. This is Paul Zimmerman. Normally, I am co-host over on the Archaeotech Podcast, but today we are taking over The Archaeology Show. And we're doing that because, I'm in the field right now. I'm in the field in Iraq on a site called Lagash, which is in southern Iraq, a Mesopotamian site, early dynastic primarily. And this is my second time here. I've talked about it a few times on the Archaeotech Podcast. And yeah, so I'm here and I'm here with a few of my colleagues, and we just wanted to cue this up, talk a little bit about what we do on this kind of a project. And we're going to come back again in a couple of weeks and tell you how it's going. And then we're going to round out this podcast episode with a final segment at the end of our dig and tell you, you know, what went right, what went wrong, what we'd like to do differently or again. Just so that our listeners can have a sense of what it's like to be on a dig like this. So anyhow, I'm here doing tech stuff primarily, big shop, doing drone work, doing some thermal imaging, again from a drone, and doing a surface survey that I designed, and we'll find out if I designed it right or if I totally goofed this. My interest, my background is in Mesopotamian archaeology, but as any of our listeners know, I hadn't been in actively field archaeology for about 20 years, and I'm now jumping back into it heavily. So my other colleagues here are Sara Pizzimenti, Zeta Rawi, and Brad Hafford, and I'm going to cue you up next here, Sara, if you could tell us what your role is here and what you hope to find.
So hi, everybody. I'm Sara Pizzimenti. I come from Italy. I'm from the University of Pisa, and here I'm the co-field director of the Lagash Archaeological Project. So for me here, this is the second season working in this project. So we started in 2019. And what we want to do during this season is to go on the survey and to the drone work that Paul is wonderfully going on. And also we wanted to do some tests from the survey into the drone work we did during the last season. So we opened some trenches in the area where the last season we went in with some drone work, in UAV drone work and survey. So we wanted to test what we did and the results we achieved during the last seasons. Then we are trying to discover if we have some housing in this areas we detected using the drone imagery during the last season. And we are now just opening our trenches and we're trying to go on. And let's hope for the best.
Well, hello. My name is Zaid Al-Rawi. I am an anthropological archaeologist from Iraq, and I am the Lagash Archaeological Project Manager. My specialization is the use of satellite imagery and remote sensing. I do spatial analysis between ancient settlement in Mesopotamia, specifically southern Mesopotamia. My role in this project is to explore the landscape around Lagash. I'm not particularly interested in features and the spatial analysis, among features within cities, but rather outside the big cities in the peripheral area. This season in particular, I am interested in a mound or small mounds area around Lagash, which they look archaeological sites, considering many factors, and I would like to explore further the nature of these mounds in relation to the main city of Lagash by doing test excavation.
Well, I'm Brad Hafford. I'm a field archaeologist from the Penn Museum, and currently I'm the field director at the ancient city of Ur, and I'm on loan to Lagash as a field supervisor, essentially. because we're not actually digging it over right now, we'll dig in the fall. So what do I do here? Dig one of the trenches, really. I have not been on Lagash until now, and we've had about 3 days of excavation. So what was I expecting? Well, I knew it was a big site, and it was mostly early dynastic. I'd seen some magnetometry and some drone photos, so I knew there were wall alignments somewhere just beneath the surface. So expecting houses of the early dynastic period, like Sara said. So that's kind of what I want to find. But we set two trenches, one of them a bit higher than the other. So why are these little mounds sometimes? Lagash is pretty flat, but there are small mounds around. So we put one on top of those and one down below. And I'm digging the one on top, and I'm not finding houses yet. In fact, I've run into kilns.
What do those kilns look like? I mean, how do you know something's a kiln as opposed to a house?
Well, they stand out pretty clearly as we clear off the dirt from the top. We get these red spots, well, they're ovals, basically, red and kind of yellow, and that's because of the burning. And then surrounding it is seems to be all of the material they dumped from it, and that's black and gray, and it's the burnt material that comes from inside. And we think they're firing pots in here, probably, although they're pretty small, so I don't know exactly how much you can fit in one of these. Now, the other thing I'm told is that in 2019, I wasn't here, but there was a trench opened that also found many of these kilns. So maybe it shouldn't be such a surprise, and maybe that's why there are these mounded areas. They're doing that on top of older houses.
Mm.
Because I think Sara can talk about the fact that her lower trench is already coming up with houses, right?
Yes, exactly. So actually, my trench is just at the bottom of one of these small mounds that Brad is talking about. And on one corner of my trench, we got part of the kilns that Brad is excavating. But then immediately underneath them, we have these houses that are just start coming up. So we expect to have the same situation in Brad's trench.
Right. I'll just have to dig through about a meter of probably burned material. Maybe there are layered kilns. I think they found kilns inside of kilns almost, older ones are beneath, and so that's kind of what I'm expecting. But one of the things about archaeology is just because you expect something, you're not necessarily going to find it. So in a couple of weeks when we do the next portion of this episode, we'll find out if we're right.
Right. So these kilns that you're finding on top of the houses that you expect, how much later in time do you think they are?
They should be like Early Dynastic 3 or maybe 3A, because according to what we found during the last season, the trench we excavated was about kilns, and those were dating to the ED3, sure.
And we would say that's about 2600, 2500 BCE? What do you think?
Well,
hard to say,
still,
right?
Still, we don't know, yes. And talking about our kilns, we have to check the pottery. I have a quick look, and it looks like there should be ED3.
Okay.
So does that mean then that the houses that you expect underneath are abandoned and this part of the site has changed use?
Well, this could be definitely a possibility that we have a change in use in this part of the site,
mm-hmm.
According to what we found so far. So right. If we have the kilns that are overlapping to the house, as I have in the trench, in the part of the trench, this was what could be happening.
Right. And we think the houses might be ED1, right? We're not sure.
Well, I'm not sure yet, but we saw something that looks like a little bit ED1, but you have to check the pottery, so you have to stay tuned to know if it is ED1 or not.
Okay, and for our listeners, what's the time difference? How many centuries between ED1 and ED3, roughly?
Well, actually, ED1 is exactly before.
It's a long period.
It's a really
starting
long period.
3,2900 BCE up to 2,600, 2,500. Yeah. So, they could be 100 years apart. They could be 200-300 years apart.
Well, we are planning to do sampling. So maybe further analysis can tell us better if we have like a gap between the two different.
And I've already gotten some really good charcoal samples from this burned material in the kiln. So hopefully we can get a carbon-14 date on that.
Right.
And in the house, we know because we already detected something. And we also have here some burned layer that can give us some charcoal to do C14 sampling and C14 analysis.
So with regards to the architecture that's underneath, you're starting to find some, Sara.
Yeah.
And you both said that you're expecting them. You're expecting them from the UAV and magnetometry work that was done here before.
Right.
Can you explain what in that imagery and that existing imagery made you think, hey, I've got houses here.
Well, thanks to the UAV drone photos we had in the geomagnetometry, we had the possibility to really look at planimetry of the structure we have immediately underneath the surface. And it looks like part of the city occupied with different structures. It looks like houses according to the planimetry. Mm-hmm. And also, we found out different neighborhood with divided by streets. So what we wanted to do was also to place one of our trenches between two buildings and even to detect roads or alleys, or we hope to, maybe we can have one of those trenches with the one alley inside, so we can also investigate how the streets works and the EV. Yeah.
Right. And also,
we don't know, we have to check.
That when you're on the site, you don't necessarily see any standing architecture. It's subterranean, I mean, subsurface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I did some drone work yesterday, and you can see these walls clear as day in some parts of the site.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And without even using something as fancy as the magnetometry, which is designed to look below the ground.
Right, because the mud bricks of walls will absorb water differently than the surrounding material. So sometimes they will just barely appear, and yet when you're in a drone, you can see these lines. It's amazing. It's like the city is there.
Exactly.
Right. So, Zaid, we're talking a lot about UAV, and you were talking about satellite work. And what about the satellite work makes you interested in, or the satellite imagery you've seen makes you interested in these smaller sites around? What makes you think that those are sites?
Well, there is, you know, some basic information that we were trained as landscape archaeologists, you know, to look at when we observe the ground, especially in a place very flat like southern Mesopotamia. So sites like when certain sites show the morphology of like something that's round or an oval shape, has some elevation above the surrounding flat plain, mm-hmm. that's good indication for it to be an archaeological site. Sometimes we see spots that happen to be looted, and that gives us almost, you know, a certain indication that this is an archaeological site. Otherwise, it would have not been, you know, attracted looters on the ground to extract materials illegally from it. Now, you know, what's special about the small sites around Lagash, the fact is, you know, there are seasonal marshes that they come and go with different proportions of water into them. It depends on the season. Certain sites, small sites, we cannot see them at all during certain seasons. Or we could see only the small tip of them that does not represent the entire small mound. So what we do is actually we go back through a historical image on Google or other kind of image to see how, you know, how much of water is in the area and how much of the site we could see. And again, we revert back to the basic indications to determine it could be an archaeological site. And at the end, we have to do ground control. And possibly, if we have more suspicion as we are on the ground, we perform test pits like what we are aiming to do, what I am aiming to do this season.
Great. So after you identify a potential site from the satellite imagery,
first,
based off of a number of different factors.
Yes.
You go then and physically get your feet on the ground there to try to see it. What kinds of things are you looking for when you get on the ground to verify that it's a site and not just some random accumulation of something?
Right. So first thing that, you know, the basic thing is, you know, typical to southern Mesopotamian sites, it's lots of cultural materials, lots of surface archaeological remains, like pottery shards, you know, and other things. If it's there, then no need to go farther. It's archaeological sites. Mm-hmm. Sometimes because of certain natural processes, or the nature of the area, like, you know, what we are looking for this season around Lagash, there are marshes, there are, you know, deposits that comes with the water of the marshes that could cover such sites with good thick layer of silt that comes from the rivers, and that possibly cause the disappearance of cultural materials right on the surface of the site. And, you know, in which case we have to dig a test hole through that test hole, trying to get to these cultural materials to verify the historical identity of these sites.
Great. No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to wrap up this segment of the episode right now and just let you know that if you hear background noises here, I hear a saw in the background, there are lots of angry sparrows. It's that we're in the storeroom of our dig house, and I actually kind of like some of the ambient noise. I hope that some of it comes through, because there's always a little bit of making do when you're in the field. And even though our dig house is wonderful, here we are all working and living together and trying to turn the outside workroom into a ad hoc podcasting studio. So until next time, in a couple of weeks, I hope that we have some really exciting new discoveries to share with you.
Chris Webster here. I have a pretty full calendar, and managing that calendar can be pretty challenging. I've got things to do every day and things I need to do once a week. Of course, people book on my calendar all the time, and I have to manage that as well. I used to move my recurring events around when something would disrupt them, but now I don't have to. This is where Motion comes in. It's an intelligent AI that manages your day for you. Put events that don't involve other people in as tasks, and Motion will move them around and break them up in ways that you dictate so you get everything done. If you'd like to take back your time and your day, then head over to arcpodnet.com/motion and check it out. That's arcpodnet.com/motion to get at least 25% more efficient with your time. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Register of Professional Archaeologists and the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com, and check out the link in the show notes.
Hi, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, segment 2. This is about 2 weeks later than the first segment, and if you notice a difference in sound quality, as I finished last segment, I was talking about how on an archaeological project you often have to make do. Well, our makeshift recording studio got turned into a bedroom and got tiled, and it's now very echoey. So we're out behind the dig house, and if you hear, you know, cattle sounds and birds and so on, that's because we're in the great outdoors right now. But like I said, it's 2 weeks later, and we have some results finally to show. So why don't we kick it off with you, Sara?
Okay. Yeah, we went on with the excavation, and we completely uncovered two wonderful buildings with a very narrow alley between them. So we decided to go on in one of the buildings, the southern one, and we uncovered a very impressive sequence of use of this building. Let's say like 6 floors, one above the others. Let's say you in your room, you redo floors when a generation passed, and so you take your house from your mother's, and then you do the floors. And that's what they do. So 6 floors, one above the other. But the most interesting thing is that when we destroyed to go down the first floor, we uncovered a wonderful roof collapse. And now we are going to discover what we had on the floors.
What does roof collapse look like?
Ashy, terrible ashy. Ashes everywhere, because it was mainly built with palms maybe and reeds. And so it was completely destroyed. It was very ashy, and a little bit of plasters on the top probably. That was the upper covers of the roof. And also, this is very interesting, on the top of it, in this collapse, we discovered like pottery smashed and bones. And so we think that probably on the top of the roof, we had some activities related to the processing of foods, because we got animal bones mainly, mm-hmm. and jars and trays and this kind of things.
All sorts of materials.
Yeah.
Zaid, you've had an interesting last couple of weeks.
I guess so. So this is going to be part of the landscape archaeology around the ancient city of Lagash. I guess, you know, in 2019 season, I thought I was blessed by that season having a plentiful of water around the site that mimic maybe the ancient formation of the marshes around the site. So it gives us, you know, more visual reality of the use of water around the city in an economic way by the ancient people. But this season, we have rather a shortage of water. And I always thought of it that is, you know, is not as a blessing. But in fact, actually, that helped us and exposed some part of the landscape, especially at the eastern side eastern side of the site of the city, which exposed a number of mounds that we were going to explore. One of them, the bigger one, the first target, you know, we put a trench in it, trying to find out about its historical identity. It turned out that that mound was more of a natural formation, was done by a flood of the marsh and the recession of water, very frequent, and there is no archaeological materials in it. So it turned out it's not archaeological, despite all the signature that we get for it by remote sensing, looking at it from the air through imagery. Now, reaching out to that site, on our way, we noticed other small mounds, and we checked them at through satellite imagery, and they were suspicious as well. Not as suspicious as the first one, but surprisingly, when we got there and explored two of them, both of them turned out to be archaeological mounds without even having to dig a trench on these locations. So we have two new archaeological sites, smaller ones next to the ancient city that needs to be declared archaeological, and that's what we are working on.
So Zaid, one of the first of those two outlying mounds, I mean, it's just off the eastern edge of the main Tell al-Hibba Lagash, you know, less than 500 meters, probably about 200 meters off it. And when we went there, Sara and I were like jumping for joy. Do you want to explain why we found it so exciting?
Yeah, so that site actually was, you know, it's almost part of the bigger city limit. It's within the city limit, right at the edge, but it's very unnoticeable, low mound. And you know, going to the other targeted sites that turned out not archaeological, we noticed this mound with a distinctive color, like brown, darker brown color. And, you know, when I stopped by and, you know, it looked like there was a bunch of surface collection on top of it, which tells us this is archaeological. We don't need to go further. But beyond this point, you know, I could not tell if the site is special or there is anything special that makes it distinctive than the rest of the mounds and, you know, as part of the city. Now, when Sara went there and you, Paul, you know, it was she quickly noticed Uruk materials on the surface of the site, which makes the site very special and dates back to the Uruk period immediately.
Right, so around 3,000 BCE.
Beyond 3,500, 3,400, something, right. Yeah.
So before the main period of Lagash, so
yeah.
That's mostly early dynastic. So.
And we have the Middle Uruk period, because one of the handles we discovered were like the torches.
Twisted
one, and it was Middle Uruk, so it was really exciting.
Wow. Our ceramicist. Brad, what have you been coming up with?
Well, mostly kilns. We knew they were there early on because of the color differentiation, very red soil because it had been burned so much. But what surprised me is just how deep they are. So we started digging one of them, and it just kept going down. We had layers of that red with a burned yellow bricky material, which I think was the superstructure of the kiln that had been broken down in. And that went down 40, 50 centimeters, and then we would hit a very hard concretion of this material and break through that. Finally, we got ash down where we think we're at the bottom. I'm not sure if I'm completely there yet, but they reach almost a meter down from the preserved surface. So I hadn't expected it to be quite that deep. So it looks like a very narrow trench, a pit that they dug, and then they would put in the fuel and the pottery, and then they would build up a kind of domed superstructure of clay. And when they fired it, of course, that clay became brick, essentially. In order to get the things out, they had to break that, and that's why it got all of the brick around. So we were finding brick like that all the way across this area, and that's another thing that I've been doing, is clearing away use surfaces. And I use that because I mean people were walking around on this surface. It's not the same as a floor inside a building. This is more like a floor outside a building. And when you walk around, you pack down things. And each one of those had very dark ash and charcoal and pottery and all of this stuff that's all packed down. So it's a bit like the interior surface that Sara was talking about, but a bit thicker. And there are even ceilings in there, which are clay that had been attached to jars or other things, and then some of them, had been stamped or rolled with a seal to identify either the owner or the materials in it or something like that. There weren't a lot of those that had the impressions on them, but we're very excited to find them. And many of those look to be early dynastic one, but I keep thinking the use surfaces are associated with the kilns, which we think are ED3A, and I don't quite get how that could be. Why does earlier material get packed into a floor? If the ash is coming from those kilns and being dumped there, why would they have early material as well? So there are things we still don't know. We'll keep digging. I'm starting to get walls in one portion of my trench. I was hoping to find houses like Sara had, and they do exist, but they're deeper down, and I'm not quite there yet.
Yeah, deeper down and also cut into, presumably.
By the kilns, yes. Certainly in half of the trench. The other half is a bit clearer, which is where we're starting to see wall alignments, and we hope to get more of that over the next week or two, and I'll tell you a bit in our next installment.
Great. And as for me, I said I had two major projects. One was the thermal imaging from the drone. That one's been, I'm not going to say a bust, I haven't given up on it yet, but it's been really problematic in that the gimbal assembly has a real hard time holding the camera still when it's up in the air. So I've been spending a lot of time adjusting all the different parameters for stabilizing that gimbal. And I think I finally have it, but the last time I flew it, I was getting terrible interference with the control system. So I flew it up, and once it was up about 20 feet, the drone decided that it had to return because it lost its communication with the controller. So I ended up also crashed the drone once, but we won't talk about that too much. The other project was the surface survey, and that one I'm going to say is a rousing success. And I designed it so it would be easy to do, so that I could train other people in, and I did a couple days by myself. It went fairly well. I made a few adjustments. Then I trained in Zaid. And Zaid promptly trained in one of our reps, Haider. And Haider then helped me translate the collection form into, so it's bilingual, both English and Arabic. And then he trained in the other rep, Abdul Halik. And so Haider and Abdul Halik have been racing through this as fast as possible, but seem to do a good job. And it's great to see, you know, all these collection loci being ticked off day by day on the map. So I think that one is a rousing success. We'll see what happens when I process the data and look at the heat maps. But in terms of the part that I could control, the how it's done and how I can train people, that one feels really good. And a side note for that is that at one of the points that I collected, I found a cylinder seal on the surface, a small early dynastic three shell kind of inscribed lines, kind of a crosshatch design cylinder seal. And it was in a location that nearby we found a human phalanx. And I think that from the distribution of pottery on the surface there, the cylinder seal, that human bone, I think that we've identified the ancient cemetery for the city, or one of the ancient cemeteries. There probably were more than one on a city of this size. So that's been pretty successful, and I've been pretty happy with it. We got a few more minutes left, so why don't you, Sara, tell us what you hope to do over the next... You're going to be stopping early, so maybe explain that. But what do you hope to do over the next couple of weeks before we wrap up?
Well, first of all, of course, I have to reach the floors in all the building I'm excavating, in all the part of the building I'm excavating. Reaching the floors, taking the materials crushed on the floors, making all the documentation about the structure. So I will do photogrammetry, 3D modeling, and so that we have all under control. And then we want to cover our trench, because in the next season we want to go down and we want to see which is the first occupation of this part of the site. So we will go down deep, I don't know how many meters. So the next week, first of all, I will finish the excavation, I will cover the trench, and then of course I have to go on with the material. So pottery till the last day.
Great. And Zaid, what are you going to be doing the next couple of weeks while we wrap up?
Well, I'll try to, you know, now that we have, you know, potentially two archaeological sites known to us, I'll try to get some diagnostic sheds, you know, for identification of the historical, you know, nature of these sites, but to put them in the expected time period that they were used back in the days. Of course, I'll need the help of my friends, Sara, here, and maybe if we have enough time, I'll, seek help from you, Paul, to do some flying and, you know, try to identify some structures, you know, subsurface structures, things like that, to collect more, you know, information to put them on file for these sites.
Right. And then we have a visitor coming down, or some visitors coming down from the Department of Antiquities, from ESPA,
yes,
tomorrow. And one of them is in charge, I believe, of registering sites.
Right.
Will you be registering these sites with her?
Definitely. At the end, yeah. Actually, they are supposed to bring some declaration form. And I think they will include some specific information about the sites. And we need to provide these informations either this season or next season. But at least now we tell them these are archaeological sites and we have the physical evidence for that.
Right. So there's a whole process already in place.
Yep.
And we have legal, moral, ethical,
reasons, yeah,
academic reasons to
yep,
to work with them on this. Brad, are you going to get rid of those damn kilns?
Well, that's one of the goals. Clean it out completely. Make sure I've got the bottom of this kiln and I understand it. We're already making 3D models of two of them. The third one is only about half done. So I want to clean those out, but I also really need to get to the architecture. So I'm likely to kind of cut the trench in half and do a 5x10 where I know I can get the architecture and understand that while I'm finishing the kilns. Instead of trying to take the whole 10x10 down and get rid completely of the kilns, it's probably going to be more parsimonious to cut only half of the trench and find those walls.
And Sada was talking about covering the architecture in her trench, and she has some pretty significant architecture. Are you going to be doing the same thing with the kilns or the walls that you find?
Certainly the walls and probably the kilns too. They are more stable. The kilns are quite baked, but I think it's best to protect everything so that we can uncover it and work again when we come back.
Great. And Sada, then when you say covering these, what do you cover them with?
We will use a plastic. This is a plastic sheet that we will use. It's a very thick one. And then we will fix this one with using some bags filled with the soil. And then, of course, because the heat we have here, we need to partially backfill the trench. So we need to cover all this plastic with at least like 10 centimeters of soil to protect everything from the sun and from the heat to avoid the destruction of the plastic.
Great. Well, let's wrap up this segment now, and we'll finish the third segment in a couple weeks as we've wrapped up the project, and hopefully we'll have some more exciting news for you then. Until then, here's this quick ad break.
Chris Webster here from the APN. You've heard me talk about Zencastr for a few months now, and there's never been a better time to check this out and start a podcast. Zencastr has hosting tools and both audio and video podcasting capability. Many of you have already clicked on the link in the show notes, and we thank you for that. Use the code TAS, that's TAS, at the link in the show notes, or go to Zencastr.com and use the code. That's Zencastr.com to get 30% off your first 3 months. Again, use the code TAS for 30% off your first 3 months at Zencastr.com. We've got a contest. The folks over at AEO Screen are giving one of our listeners a brand new screen. Pick anything from their website and they'll ship it to you. Not an archaeologist? No problem. These are great for gardening and other tasks around the house. I mean, come on, right? Anyway, these are great screens and you won't be disappointed. We'll pick the winning entry at the end of May. Head over to arcpodnet.com/screen for details on how to enter. It's easy and you can get multiple entries. Increase your chances by helping out others. That's arcpodnet.com/screen for details on how to win. Want to keep this conversation going? Want to talk to the hosts of this show and other fans? Then join our membership program and get exclusive access to the hosts, other fans, and early access to these episodes and bonus segments and content. You'll also get forever access to our live show back catalog and any other shows ad-free. Head over to arcpodnet.com/members for details. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show. This is segment 3. We're not at Lagash anymore. I'm sure you can tell by the soundscape changing yet again that we are in a new location. We are waiting in the waiting room, because that's what one does, at the Basra Airport, ready to take our flights back home. We don't have Zaid with us today. He's on his way up to Baghdad to take care of some business with the Department of Antiquities. So it'll just be Sada, Brad, and me. And then I'll rope Zaid into a remote call so we can round this out. Let's see. Overall, it's been a pretty good season.
Absolutely. Wonderful season.
So let me start with you, Sara. Wonderful season. What was good about it?
Well, first of all, we were excavating a lot. So we were pretty excited what we found. Very interesting discoveries and a lot of work to do later in the future days and months. And what about tons of pottery? Mm-hmm. And moreover, we process all, so we were able to really accomplish our goal to excavate and process all the material we found. We found different kind of contexts. We were able to investigate the part of the site and to connect all the trenches we've done according to the time and the period we excavated. So we were have a little bit more information about what happened in this southern part of the site.
Right, and that's really big, having actually processed almost everything that we collected.
Yeah, talking about pottery, we have more than 900 pottery shards we drawn to diagnostic, and so if we have to think about how many pottery shards we processed, we have to multiply it for 10 at least. So we should have around maybe 9,000 pottery shards we processed or more.
How about Brad? You had a pretty good season. Yours was a little more interesting in the sense of interesting, like in the Midwest interesting. Huh.
You mean difficulties in some ways.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I think that what I like to talk about is how things kind of changed in the different stages of this excavation and what we were seeing. Mm-hmm. So I had said last time that I was surprised that the kilns had gone so deep.
Yeah.
And this time I'm surprised that the walls had not, that they were so shallow. Well, apparently they were hard to find because they're made of mud brick and they're surrounded by fallen mud brick. And then when we did find them, we got a floor or two, not quite what I would have expected multiple floors because these walls seem to have been altered often. But looking just a little below one of the floors, it looks like the walls kind of stop after 10 centimeters, or 15 maybe. And there's just not a lot to look at there because the tops of walls are often very poorly preserved and you want more depth in order to look at that wall more carefully. So we didn't quite get that. I do have the wall, but there are a few that I'm not quite certain of. And, well, what can you do except come back next season and hope that there are walls beneath it that are in better shape and that show us the organization a little bit clearer?
Yeah, and let's see. I'm actually going to pop your bubble about getting all the processing done.
Well, what about your survey? Yeah.
So on the survey, we took over 700 collections. And we processed all but about 30 of them. And I was pushing and pushing to get it done and didn't quite. But we do have enough to get to generate some preliminary heat maps where we can see the distribution of different kinds of artifact types by broad class. And there are two really good hot spots of slag of various types. One of them just to the north and east of where we were excavating. So it might be interesting to look there. But, it was a lot of fun. I don't know if this happened before or I don't remember if this happened just before or just after the last recording, but we were doing some more drone work around different parts of the site and found additional clear traces of massive city walls. And that was really exciting.
I think that happened after.
So now we're beginning to get a better sense between the excavations where we can see the architecture. We can correlate that to the magnetometry that was done before. We can correlate both of those to what we're seeing immediately subsurface from the aerial. We're starting to get these heat maps that might tell us a little bit about different use zones at different time periods and across the site. So we're starting to be able to bring all these different strands of information together.
And now we know that the structure we're finding in my trench and the ones you are finding in your trench are for sure ED1.
Yeah, right, because on one of our floors we did have, there wasn't much on most of them, but one of them had a beaker or goblet.
It was like a goblet.
What?
Yeah, goblet. So for sure, right.
That was definitely ED1.
Yeah, so actually, ED1, the pottery?
According to the pottery.
Was almost entirely ED1 that you had? Or?
No, the upper faces, my upper faces are ED3A, so it's connected with his faces, the kilns probably.
Yeah,
but then the structure he found is ED1, so it's connected to my ED1. We have to see how they correlate.
Right.
But at least we know that we got ED1 structures.
Well, and I haven't yet looked at what you processed from the survey, but is there any patterns that you've seen emerging from that?
hard to tell now, but yeah, for sure we know that there is also something that Edie wanted. We found the pottery of the survey, not just Edie 3, but too early to tell.
Right, and the pottery different than from the excavations. Yeah, is from a deflated surface, so it's different post-depositional processes.
And one of our aims in the beginning, anyway, choosing trenches kind of uphill from one another, was to see how they interacted and what were the phases, and I think we've accomplished that. That's good.
Yes, is there anything surprising from this season?
Everything was surprising.
It always is, right? To some extent, yeah. Hmm.
Was there anything that was kind of awful, something that you really didn't like about anything on the project or in the archaeology?
Absolutely not.
No.
No, this was a really good season.
Everything was great.
And there's a lot that makes a good season, but one of them is the people, and I think we had a really great team.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you tell me about what we found that was really impressive or interesting. Well, we found seal impressions.
Yeah,
and that's true.
Tons of seal impressions. Yeah, actually, so just sometimes just the back, sometimes, and so we have the administrative hints that took place there, and ED1 seal impressions.
I don't know if you can hear Dr. Holly Pittman in the background here chiming in, but seal impressions.
Just seal impressions, right? Really? They are very diagnostic. They are very sensitive chronologically, as well as interesting iconographically for all sorts of reasons. So ceramics together with seal impressions really do allow us, will allow us to build something quite precise.
Inshallah. Augusta.
The street.
The street. Since we normally record just the four of us, you know, hiding out, but we're most of the team here right now, Dr. Augusta McMahon has a couple things she wants to say about the street.
Yeah, so the entire reason that we chose the area that we chose to excavate in, because we had some magnetometry from 2019 that showed a whole network of different sizes of streets. So one of the trenches, Sarah's Trench, was over an alley, and that was really interesting just to see the width of that and some of the deposits from that. And the trench that the Cambridge team excavated had a very large street in it. And the interesting thing about it was we could see it really clearly in the magnetometry, and it had borders to it. But when we actually excavated it, it actually had three phases. So in the initial phase, it was entirely used. Then over time, it seems to have retracted down so that only one part of the street was used, and a sort of groove or rut was eroded into it. And then in a third phase, that was filled with trash. So we can actually see sort of the development of the use of streets that also should affect the other structures that are around and the kind of households that we have living next to these, living next to the street over the period of time that it's in use. So in the sort of middle of the early dynastic period, again, it's a sort of useful, streets can be incredibly useful for just judging changes within this entire structure of the city. So it was great, their houses, but I actually found that our street was fantastic for actually giving us a really good sense of the internal changes that are happening within the city in this early dynastic period. It also had amazing trash in it, so all kinds of animal bones and fish bones and bitumen that was being used for some kind of crafting nearby and so on. So streets are excellent. I can really encourage anyone who's thinking about excavation to excavate streets, because they give you this sort of perfect picture of what people are throwing out. And archaeology, of course, is trash.
Thanks, Augusta. You can now hear the requisite scream baby, and that we're going to have to board in just a minute. So I'm going to cut this segment kind of short right now. I will get back in touch with Zaid, and we'll record a little bit with him to hear his thoughts. But for me, I really enjoyed working with all of you. This was a great season, a lot of fun, learned a lot, got to explore a bunch of things. Archaeologically, learned a lot about the archaeology of Sumer and about, you know, the conduct of it, and so it was a great experience overall. Again,
great to have you, Bob.
Why, thank
really.
You.
It's a huge difference.
So
he fixed the washing machine. He helped us.
Internet,
right? He was able to manage everything.
All right, so if you didn't get the sense from before, it takes a whole bunch of different types of people with a whole bunch of different types of skills on a good project to make it work.
Right.
So I was Mr. Fix-It for a bit.
In addition to Mr. Drone Flyer.
And Mr. Drone Pilot.
But
anyhow.
And Survey, Mr. Survey.
Well, Mr. Survey
Mr.
was
Survey.
Helped immensely, again, all kinds of people, by our reps who did the bulk of the survey work, and by your students who did the bulk of the analysis and the weighing and measuring of all these materials. So, you know, the good cooperative project that way.
Absolutely.
All right. I'll get back to you soon with Zaid's thoughts, and until next time, bye. Hi, Zaid. Welcome back. It's been a couple days since I've seen you. You know, we recorded everybody else in the airport in Basra, but you weren't there because you had to run up to Baghdad instead. That wasn't part of our original plan. You were going to fly back with us, but things came up. Do you want to let our listeners know what you're doing in Baghdad?
Yeah, so I'm following up closely on releasing the samples, the geoarchaeological samples that we collected from and around the city of Lagash. And it's been a bit challenging, but we are hoping to get the samples from this season and the second season back in November. And hopefully, you know, in a day or two, I'll be able to collect, to, you know, pick up these samples and transfer them to the States to do analysis on them to find out about many, many, many information. The main information will be toward the, you know, determining how far up was the head of the current Gulf.
Right. That's a big part of Reed's dissertation. I don't know if we mentioned Reed outright in the early recordings, but he's Dr. Pittman's grad student. And and he's been having a devil of a time get these soil core samples out of the country. But hopefully you're going to be victorious this time. And I'll see you probably next week back here in New York with those soil samples in hand. Fingers crossed, right?
Fingers crossed, yeah.
So we were wrapping up, you know, in the airport, just talking about the project overall. And our general sense, each of us felt like it was a pretty successful season. How was your sense about it? Did you enjoy the season?
I did. I certainly did, actually. You know, now thinking about the season and how it went, I look back and I see, I really appreciate the time we were at Lagash, you know, this last month. You know, 2019, as I mentioned before, you know, I thought I was, you know, the luckiest person, you know, landscape archaeologist, you know, watching the water, plenty of water filling the marshes around Lagash. And I was observing, you know, what does that mean to the environment, how the environment looks like with this plentiness of water, and what does it mean to the, you know, to the behavior of the, you know, settlers of the area. Because it's likely that, you know, people at Lagash and around Lagash have been taking advantage and dealing with, you know, this environmental changes. And, you know, there's a lot of water. People started to use the water to transportation. You know, kids go in the morning and set their nets right in the front of their yards, basically, and taking advantage of the, you know, any economic, you know, items that they could get through the marshes, things like that. And I thought, you know, I was very lucky to see that. But this season, actually, you know, we are at Lagash, and approximately at the same time, you know, March to April, and there isn't much of water, there is less water, and the landscape does look different, and people behave differently, you know, or react differently for these changes. You see, for example, now they have enough land. It's not covered by water because there isn't enough water. They do cultivate the lands, you know, wheat and barley, and they have their animals, you know, graze these lands, you know, after, you know, cultivation. There isn't much of, you know, fishing in the area because there isn't much of water. And if there is a little of water, it's not deep enough. And, you know, it's semi-dry this season. You see a lot of small sites exposed, you know, in the marsh next to Lagash that, you know, otherwise, if, you know, in 2019, we would not be able to, you know, see them. So these are all small settlements that they existed. So, you know, I really appreciate the time, you know, the exact time with different faces of the earth around Lagash. That gives me an opportunity to reflect, you know, on how people behave and react to to the existence of water, less water or more water. What does that mean? Things like that. So I really like it. I think now, I'm double lucky.
Yeah, I think that we are double lucky to have you actually on the project too. As an Iraqi, you have an appreciation of the history and the landscape and are seeing these connections in a way that the rest of us maybe aren't, between the ancient past and how people cultivated the land and where the water was and how they used the waterways and the animals and all the above, and the modern present, which has definitely changed and it's not directly analogous. It informs our understanding of the past. And and so it's nice that you have that personal connection to the place and to the space and to the time. So, I'm just going to leave it at that because we've got another season coming up in the fall. Maybe we'll record again and hopefully we'll have some new results, some new developments, some new theories, some new things that we can test. But in the meantime, this has been a fantastic season. I think that we all agree. We learned a lot, and it was so good to have you and everybody on the project because we brought all these different perspectives, these different skills and aptitudes and interests, and everybody worked together really nicely as a team, bringing their different different skills.
Absolutely.
And like your Iraqi perspective was absolutely invaluable for that. So thanks, Zaid.
Thank you, Paul.
And I guess I'll sign off this podcast right now. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks for listening. Please consider joining our growing core of members over at archpodnet.com/members. If you liked what you heard, consider leaving a review wherever you're listening to this.